हरिः प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
Two 14. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress, and their disappearance in due course, are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O Skayanabharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. And so in other words, the happiness and distress is simply because of our perception. Like that. It's not that it's specifically this makes happiness or this is distress. We perceive it that way, as we discussed before. One situation, one person will perceive it as something very good, someone else will perceive it as very bad. The exact same situation. So it's simply our perception. We'll say, no, no, in reality it's good, in reality it's bad. No, it's you've interpreted it as good, and you've interpreted it as bad, yes.
I thought we were at the second part of the paragraph.
Yeah.
Second part of the paragraph.
it explains as in Srimad Bhagavatam, that's where we're up to.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
it is explained thus in Srimad Bhagavatam there.
Sir.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You have no idea.
I have no idea. I didn't get to study with Srimad
Bhagavatam. I was lying.
Really? Not fortunate.
I don't know if I'm in the doghouse or.
I see.
I think he just went to Kolkata or something.
He went to Hong Kong.
He went to Hong Kong. Just my luck.
It is explained thus in the Srimad Bhagavatam 2931. The knowledge of the self and the supreme self is very confidential and mysterious. But such knowledge and specific realization can be understood if explained with their various aspects by the Lord Himself. Right. So this transcendental knowledge, mysterious means it's not something that you'll be able to understand on one's own. It's not possible. But if it's explained by the Lord, then you can. Because otherwise we have our idea of what's reality. Reality is what we feel, what we perceive. And we'll call that real. But there's so many living entities, and they all have their reality. Like Prabhupada gives the example of if you take a young attractive girl, right? So for a young qualified man, then she is a very desirable object, right? For the sadhu, then simply is, you know, mucus, bile, and air, right? And for a dog, it's something nice to eat. You understand? So three very different perceptions on the same, you know, situation. So we're so used to that we don't actually know what's reality. Reality is how God sees it. That's why Krishna consciousness is so clear, consistent. All devotees within the movement basically have the same understanding, same perspective. There may be more or less realization on it, or more or less knowledge of technical detail, but it's the same because we're using God's perception. His perspective, right, which is the reality, right? Because, you know, it's a fact it's like this, and it's a fact he made it like this because of a certain purpose, right? So how he defines the creation, that's actually how it is. It's not a matter of, like yesterday, you know, but, you know, this is the modern age and things are different. No, God made the universe, not man. Right? So it's not a matter of the various perceptions of man that actually changes the reality. No, it changes it for yourself. But it's just a matter of what illusion you're under. You know, it's like, you know, today it's popular we're all Napoleon Bonaparte, and then tomorrow it's all, you know, popular that we're, you know, Obama or something. You know, so it's like, you know, whatever's going on, whatever's the popular trend in the insane asylum, you know, then we can't call that reality. You know, because it goes from one end to the other. I mean, one of the, you know, I mean, there's so many examples. The one comes to mind is like, you know, the American public was still a bit running on the, you know, 60s and 70s kind of, you know, dovish kind of anti-war kind of, you know, kind of scene. So it's not something very popular. It's kind of the democratic view. It's the, you know, the enlightened, educated view, the, you know, coming out of the colleges of the U.S. And so everything's like that. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, no one has much good to say necessarily about the government, but it's okay, and this and that, but, you know, the peace and all that. And that's going on, and that's been going on for, you know, 30 years, 40 years. You know, just kind of like that. Then you have the 9/11 incident. Bang! That day, everybody's putting up flags. I remember driving, just, you know, a little bit after, driving down, and no, it was a couple of years later, driving down the streets through the New York area. It's like every third house has a flag. And not just, you know, a small little flag, full-size flag hanging from their front porch, or they've even gone to the trouble of installing a real flagpole. Generally, you only see them at, you know, schools and government offices. They got them in the front yard, you know? And then you're driving along, and cars have flags. You know how you stick on little, you know, the little metal things, you have little flags. They have car flags. It's just like everybody was just so patriotic. Bang, the same people that the day before, it's like, you know, well, you know, all this kind of, they bang, no, oh, yeah. And then that went on really strong until, you know, the government got a little too confident with it. And then when they went into Iraq, then it kind of went back, it dropped a bit and was kind of in between the two, you know. You understand? So just like that, bang, one incident happens, everybody's mood changes. You know, so that's all throughout. You know, everybody's going along and they're, you know, it's all like this. And then, you know, suddenly there's the French Revolution or there's a Russian Revolution. There's just something happens. And the whole mood, the whole perception changes. The reality changes. You know? You know, what was before was thought of as something nice. The person knows some of the subtle sciences and they have some intuition in the area. And, you know, it's considered an ornament to their personality. And it's so nice to be in such a, you know, more refined or more subtle or, you know, a community. And then, bang, suddenly now they're witches and now the fun's burning them at the stake. The same people. The huge amount of the population of the world today who are also Christian, would be burnt at the stake if this was in the 1600s. They would. You know what I'm saying? So it's just perception changes. What was reality before is not. So we have to get very, very... We have to be able to appreciate that reality is God's... how he sees it. Because that's actually the way it is. And how he sees it includes how we can see it. So it's a combination of how the Lord sees it and how the devotees see it in relationship to the Lord. Right? So the Lord's associates, these great personalities, how they see it, that is the reality. Anything else is not. It's illusion. Right? Yes.
So because of our conditioning, we have different levels of realization of God's reality.
Say that again.
Different levels of realize. I mean, God has one perspective. That's the real reality.
Yes.
Because of our conditioning, we have different, I mean, abilities to see that perspective or
yes,
not
yes,
see.
Like that. But the problem is because we don't conclude it, or if we, because even though we may different persons, are, means if there's some success, if there's some unity, if there's some progress, it's simply because one's getting a glimmer of some aspect of the reality.
Mm.
But one is not attributing it to reality, therefore it keeps one in illusion. So it's just a matter of time for that to change.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Mm. You know, one gets some confidence, so one's doing well, but then he becomes very puffed up and overconfident, so then he's not actually looking at the situation anymore, right? It means the person's unconfident, so he doesn't even notice opportunities and things that he could do. Because he's so absorbed in himself. Then he comes somehow or another becomes confident. So now he's very aware of the situations, really takes advantage of it, he's on a roll. But then because of that being on a roll, all that success, he again becomes just aware of himself and it doesn't matter the situation anymore. So now he makes failures as much as the person who's underconfident. Right? So underconfident, overconfident means it's about yourself. If you're confident, then you're actually focused on the environment. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So therefore, you're aware of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Then, according to your karma, how much you're able to perceive.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? But the problem is it's temporary because of this lack of God consciousness. Devotees, they can be consistent because they know it's not themselves. So therefore, as the modes of nature are moving and changing, it doesn't. They don't become bewildered, right? Is that what you're saying? So that's. So only when Krishna explains. That's why we will say, "Oh, why not? Well, somebody else could, you know, figure." No, no one can figure it out because unless you see it in connection with God, right? And that is only because God's explained that. Otherwise, in the, here, how you would see? How you would know? You know? Because there's all varieties of sentimental ideas of what is God consciousness. You know, there may be some little touch of something that has some reality, but then there'll be a whole lot of what's not a reality.
You know? It will always change also, right?
Yeah, it'll always be changing. You know, it's like we want to be, you know, the ideas were bound by material consciousness. Right? So that means we're able, through proper knowledge, that will make us free. That'll give us the sense of freedom. But we bring up that thing as, no, I want to be free from this consciousness, so I want to be free like a bird. But birds aren't free. They just fly around in the air. You know, because for them to walk on the ground is really slow. You know, like that. It's not very efficient. Right? Unless you're a kiwi bird or something, and then that's as good as it gets. You know, it's not going to get any better than that.
Ostrich?
Yeah, ostrich also. Yes. Moa? Are there any left? No, they ate them all. Right? Dodos also. Yeah. Oh, yes. So, being free like a bird, then that's not freedom. It appears to be soaring like this because you're connecting the aspect of, you know, within the spiritual consciousness to be soaring within that. But it's a matter of understanding, not of actual flight. So, therefore, you don't need to go up on top of buildings and take off your clothes because birds do have feathers. You know, they're just somehow or another connected. So I could see maybe gluing your clothes on, and then you could say, now I'm like a bird. But to take off your clothes so you're like a bird. No, but birds wear feathers. You know what I'm saying? But have you ever seen a motley bird? You understand motley means, you know, their hair, feathers are falling out, so some feathers are there, some are not. They don't look very confident. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So you understand the point we're making. The sentiment is fine, but we're mixing it with material concepts, so that's why we never actually get beyond. So it's only when knowledge is given by God Himself. So that means God Himself, and then it comes down through the Parampara as God gives it in the scriptures. That then gives the real reality. Then we know what to, how to look at it. Right? You know, the analogy used by the freedom of the bird is the bird, how high they fly. Because different birds fly to different heights. So accordingly, according to our realization, we can be at a particular height of God realization. But it's just mentioning that kind of aspect. Okay. Bhagavad Gita gives us that general and specific knowledge of the self. The living entities are parts and parcels of the Lord, and therefore they are simply meant to serve the Lord. This consciousness is called Krishna consciousness. Right, so the general, this is general, then very specific detail of how that functions. So, from the very beginning of life, one has to learn this Krishna consciousness. And thereby, one may become fully Krishna conscious and act accordingly. So, why from the very beginning of life? So, from the very beginning of life, that means very, very beginning means the Garbhadhan. So, it's the consciousness of the parents, so therefore, that Krishna consciousness is already, I say, infused into the living entity. Then that training goes on. Because the point is if we get too used to the illusory functioning of the world, then it will be harder to change that later. It's not an idea, they're kids, just leave them alone, let them play, don't worry about it. But then they'll just play and then they'll think the place is just for, you know, happiness and distress, all these things that the next verse is dealing with. They'll be disturbed by them. No, but they have to be explained. Of course, they're kids, so how much they can practice, that's another thing. That's the point. They're children, so their practices may not be so stable. But it's not that they can't know the fundamentals of the philosophy and be using them in their life. Yeah. 2:14, O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. It means if it's winter, it's cold, it will warm up. You know, and if it's hot, it will cool down. It's just the way it works. They arise from sense perception, because someone will say winter's nice, someone else will say winter's terrible, the other will say summer's nice, and the other will say summer's terrible. Right? I remember when Sahotamar was first coming and staying, you know, long time with us, not in this campus, in the old campus. So then he would come for the festival and stay for 2 months after the festival. So it's basically the hottest time of the year. So, you know, for the first, you know, some while, I was saying, oh, sorry, it's so hot and this and that. And because, you know, that summer happened to be a really hot summer. And all that shit, he's saying, no, it's great. And I was thinking he's just being polite. And then one time he explained it. You know, I sit in Europe, you know, through the whole fall and the winter, you know, time. And just from, you know, all that time, you know, the cold just gets right into your bones, you know, like that. You know, it's always wet and cold and miserable and windy. So he says it's very nice to just be someplace where it's warm. You know, it just kind of like, you know, bakes all the moisture out of your bones and you feel, you know, human again. So, you know, we didn't have the moist bones, so therefore, you know, it was hot to us, but for him it was really nice. Does that make sense? So this is just, that's the whole point. It's just perception, and one turns into the other. One must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. Right? Because you can be disturbed, but that doesn't change anything. It's the way it is. You can be so disturbed that it's summer, but it won't change that it's summer. Right? It's just the way it is. One should perform his duties. In the proper discharge of duty, one has to learn to tolerate non-permanent appearances and disappearances of happiness and distress. In the proper discharge of duty, right? So it means you perform your duties that you're supposed to, then there's always going to be non-permanent appearances of happiness and distress, right? That's why Krishna is always focusing on the proper discharge of duty, right? Because in that, then will come along all the things that are nice or not so nice, right? There's no separate, right? The other day we had the discussion, do we have to separately endeavor for developing, you know, this tolerance and humility and all these nice qualities that have been mentioned throughout all these verses of Gita? There's absolutely no reason to separately, because all the opportunity you'll ever need comes up in the discharge of your duties. Does that make sense? So the point is we have all those problems because of non-proper performance of our duties. Right? Because if you perform your duties properly, you don't get bad results. Right? So bad results are coming because of not performing nicely. Right? Does that make sense? And if you perform nicely so the environment's always pious, there's also the tendency that it becomes, you know, very regular, very common and very ordinary that things are nice. So even though others would consider it a very ecstatic environment, it's just very ordinary for the pious person. Right? So they get conditioned to goodness. Right? So then these things are always changing. So proper discharge of duty means then you will, whatever it is that you need to practice is already there by the discharge of your duties, because you have these particular duties because of your previous activities. So if they've been good, then you have to learn to not be disturbed by not so much nice. You know, and if it's bad, you still have to do your duties because you didn't do your duties before, that's why it's bad. And then within your duties, not get overly distracted by the niceness of the material world. Yes.
What we hear over again is that you have to get out of your comfort zone. It's actually very dangerous just to coast.
Coasting, yes, but comfort zone meaning what is the area, the field of comfort is fine. That's natural. But to just coast along in that field of comfort, that you want to avoid, because that means you're not focusing, you're not endeavoring. But to just say, get out of your comfort zones to do things that have nothing to do with your nature. It's really nice. Who's saying that? Someone who is a little bit more on the wild side. So why don't they get out of their comfort zone and go sit down in a, you know, in the science library at MIT, you know, with all the nerds there, and just, you know, read some quantum or something. That would be right out of their comfort zone. But no, they're saying, get out of your comfort zone. Hey, let's bungee jump off of the school, you know, administrative building, you know, like that. You know, but that's all they do is do crazy things. That's their comfort zone. You know what I'm saying? So we have to be very careful between those who are just crazy and trying to bring out some inspiration in life in a naturally conservative person, and someone who's talking about, you know, you're rightly situated, but you're just not making that dynamic endeavor, right? So one is going to be the successful person, and the other is going to be the wild person. So the wild person, even though it may start the process moving, like kick-starting something, but once the car started, you don't keep pushing it. So one or two times doing something insane that you never did before wakes you up that you can be more dynamic. But then once you go into functioning dynamically in one's own field, does that make some sense? So one would have to distinguish there. Otherwise, then, you know, it's a great, you know, it's one of those phrases, you know, that sounds great. Just by saying it, you've solved all the problems. So you just got to get out of your comfort zone. What is the comfort zone?
Well, in our context, it's you have to do books. What is this? Just sitting around here.
Sitting around doing what?
In the temples.
Doing what?
Sitting in the dharma.
Doing what? The point is they get out of their comfort zone, they wouldn't be able to come and sit their butt down here. How many hardcore book distributors could sit here? But they'll say it's no because you got to go out and distribute books. I guarantee, in one day, I can remember one time distributing 1,000 books in one day. You name me one top book distributor who's ever done that in their life. 1,000. And I sat in one place. I didn't even have to move around. Oh, it's just there were so many people, you couldn't move around. I had one book distribution thing where you had the books in your bag, right? I couldn't give out the books fast enough. People were simply pulling the books out of the bag and putting the money in the bag and walking off. Anybody's had that experience? So, that you can get right here. But how many are doing it? Rosh Purnima, you know, those 3 days. Lakhs of people come through. And they're here for spiritual things, so they're happy to buy. How many book tables are here in this place? But those brahmacharis sit there all day. But they can't do it. So this is out of their comfort zone. They just like being in that thing. You wear the karmic clothes, you got your bag, you got your lines, you got your thing. Here it's just, you know what my line was? Ek rupee. I just hand them the book and go, 1 rupee. And then they look at the book, and they either hand me a rupee or hand me the book. You know what I'm saying? So, the whole point is it sounds very nice because they're into book distribution. But the whole point is they can only do those books because someone is making some arrangement. If there were no temples and no deities and no festivals and no association and no prasad now and again, they would not be out there doing books. They'd be sitting in their comfortable little West Coast apartment, you know, with their rattan furniture and, you know, the little this and that and their pushback and, you know, all that kind of jazz. And, you know, that's what they'd be doing. But if they can do that because the temples are there, so that's why it's called Samkirtana. So they're doing book distribution within Sankirtan. It's not that book distribution is Sankirtan and everything else is not. Because if it's out of their, you know, get out of your comfort zone, how long do they last? Now, if one of the ones that is, you know, after 30 years is still distributing books, and that's how, if they're Brahmachari, they're still doing it, if they're Grihastha, that's how they maintain themselves, then let them tell us that. They have a right to say something. But anybody else, 2, 3 years, 5 years, and then they're gone. You don't even know what happened to them. You know, those hardcore North European, you know, get out there and, you know, kick butt and, you know, we're the guys and we're doing the real service. Where are they all now? They don't even visit the temple. You know what I'm saying? So they have to be very, very careful about using these little pat terms just because they have an ability to be a salesman. You know, okay? Because they're doing book distribution, but on what level? That any level is good, but to make those kind of comments means they're going out, they're telling you this is a spiritual book, this has transcendental knowledge, this will allow, you know, help you understand, you know, answer your questions of your, you know, all those questions you want to know about, you know, so take this book. And then they are happy gaining the spiritual knowledge and they give you a dakshin, a donation, because you've given them this book. But if you're going out there just because you're a salesman and you love to collect money or love to sell things, then that's there, but at the same time as the same guy, you know, a few years later is selling stickers at the, you know, whatever the band's playing their concert. You know, maybe hats, maybe t-shirts. You know what I'm saying? So the point is it's not a matter of getting out of your comfort zone. Book distribution, getting out of your comfort zone. Yes, it is. On one level. But it's not out of their comfort zone. They're comfortable being out there. So either if it's by spiritual determination that was something they would never be doing, then fine. But if that's something they would be doing, you know, the guy's a crack businessman and he's a great book distributor, it's not out of his comfort zone at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. It's just being dynamic in the area of his own comfort. So the whole idea that Krishna is saying in the Gita is understand your conditioning and engage that conditioning in Krishna's service. That's the whole point. You know, I can imagine, you know, you go out on books and one of the, you know, it says this new devotee, one of the points that, you know, you very much look forward to, you know, once they drop you off out of the bus on some parking lot, is lunch. You know? And the point is, but how is their lunch? Somebody cooked it. You know, somebody went to the trouble to cook it. And it's not just cooking, you have to go to the market, you have to prepare it, you have to cook it, it has to be offered, you have to clean up the kitchen and all that. That takes a lot of the day. During that time, you know, the book distributor was chanting his japa, going to Guru Puja, you know, hearing some philosophy and doing all this and that. So now he's prepared for it. The other one's just finished, you know, by 11 o'clock now, he's or 12 o'clock, but he's been going since 5 or 6 in the morning. So just when the book distribution gets out there and hits the lot, he's already, you know, done a lot of service. So try that. Why don't we switch your role? Okay, the guy, the cook's supposed to get out on the parking lot, get out of your comfort zone. Okay, great. Book distribution in the kitchen. Cut the peel these potatoes. You know, oh, but this isn't the highest. No, but the whole point is if they don't do this, you starve to death. You know? And that, no, we'll just buy something. Yeah, so that means then, you know, Planters Peanut Factory and the guy who owns it and whoever, you know, the Amish who owns the Philadelphia cream cheese factory. You know, they're you know, you're dependent upon them.
I think it was sour cream and nachos.
Oh, that's the new one. Okay. Yeah. Are there? It was a block of Philadelphia cream cheese and a can of Planters Peanuts. And that was like the. That was our time. I heard the generations before it was you get a block of butter and then a thing of sugar and just put it there to eat it. You know, talking about the cold butter, not you know, because otherwise it melts, you can't stick the sugar, it just disappears. And then before that, they were more intelligent. They would take this condensed milk,
yeah.
You know, boil those, but they boil them for 3 hours instead of two, so they're really solid and dark. And then you open both ends of the cans and just push them out. And you'd have a whole stack of them. Then you take Philadelphia cream cheese and cut it in large chunks and throw it into that mix, that and kind of, you know, slightly mix it up. Then you take large spoons, take a bunch of that and put it on everybody's bowl, right? And you eat that. Then you go out on Harinam for 12 hours. So that was, so Jamar's is telling that's what they used to eat before they went out on Harinam. So that was, I think they used to call it Eagle Rock because it was Eagle brand condensed milk, and I'm not sure, maybe because of the cream cheese, it looked like rocks or something. It was like a mountain of the.
It came out like a rock.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's you know. So each generation had its. Now they're up to nachos and. What did you say?
And sour cream.
And sour cream. Okay, they moved from cream cheese is too solid to sour cream. Okay. Okay. In the proper discharge of duty, one has to learn to tolerate non-permanent appearances and of disappearances of happiness and distress. One has to follow the prescribed rules and regulations of religious principles in order to rise up to the platform of knowledge. Right? Prescribed rules and regulations, religious principles, because that will help one to rise up to the platform of knowledge. Because that's the point is that these rules and regulations themselves are purifying. They'll raise you to the platform of knowledge. That's the problem with the modern cultural environment. There's nothing there to raise you to the platform of knowledge. Right? So it's only if you connect that to Krishna, then you'll get the devotional understanding. Right? But itself is not situating you on the platform of goodness. So it's only because of its connection. right? So following the rules and regulations that are given, you know, by the Shastra, that situates you in goodness and gives you the devotional element. Yeah, does that make sense? So your situation is goodness, and then your consciousness is devotional. And the other, your consciousness is devotional, so you're getting the spiritual benefit, but the material side is not actually elevating. Mm-hmm. Right? So if the focus is enough on the devotional, that will actually overpower the other one. It'll work. Right? But if somehow or another the mind is pulled back from that, then, you know, you just fall right back down into passion and ignorance. Right? Does that make sense? You know, that's why it's like we were saying, so gung-ho, and then it's like, where are they? You know what I'm saying? But like you have, let's say you have some of the Indians, you know, like that, pious families, nice like that. So they come to the temple, they're around there, they're fired up and all that. And then, you know, something happens, you don't see them for months. So what are they doing during those months? You know, basically living a life of goodness. You know, so then if they do come in contact again because they got distracted, some business thing came up or the grandmother was sick or something like that, then bang, they're right back. There's no issues because it's just, you know, pure goodness down to goodness, pure goodness down to goodness. You know, but when you're going from passion and ignorance up to pure goodness, passion and ignorance up to pure goodness, you know, it can be a little wild. So that's why this is recommended. Not that you couldn't do the other thing, but it's just why use that as a, you know, unless you're, you know, really, really enjoy roller coaster rides, then, you know. Because by knowledge and devotion only can one liberate himself from the clutches of Maya, illusion. So you have the knowledge, but you're using it for Krishna, so the devotion, so knowledge and devotion. Because the devotion means it's service, so you're going to apply the knowledge in activity, but you're not going to apply the knowledge into just mode of goodness activity, you're going to apply the knowledge into devotional activity. So the two are important. You know? And then there's also the other thing of the comfort zone of the book distributor. Does he read the book? Sit down for 2 hours, read the book. You know? Generally the good ones do that. That's why they're able to continue. So is he distributing books because of his natural mode of passion, and so he's connected that to Krishna, and therefore is doing a great job? You know, or it's that he actually understands the value of the book itself, not just distributing the book, but the book itself. Because the point is, somebody gets the book, now what? Then just they're supposed to distribute the book? Okay, and then they've distributed it, and they get the book. Now, what do? They distribute it? Okay, until the whole planet has distributed the books, and that everybody's got the books. Now what? Is anybody going to study it? Is anybody going to practice it? What about that? So that's not mentioned. You know, so that's why it's a nice concept, but it's said with you got to get out of your comfort zone, Prabhu. But that's like saying you got to change your nature, Prabhu. It's impossible. It's foolish to say. You know, like that. Okay. Footnote 6. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 9:13:27. In the world of duality, that is to say, in the material world, so called goodness and badness are both the same. Badness, yeah. Goodness and badness. And all you need is the ugliness. Right, right, you know. So, the same, because there's no good and bad, if it's not connected to Krishna, it's all useless.
Arbitrary.
Yeah, it's arbitrary, because you've said it's this and said that you can switch them around.
That's why young people say bad.
Bad, yeah.
Like, that's bad.
Yeah.
Never know what's actually good and bad. Yeah. Just switch the...
Yeah, yeah. Therefore, in this world, to distinguish between good and bad, happiness and distress, is meaningless because they are both mental concoctions, mano-dharma. Because everything here is miserable and troublesome. Right? So all it is that what's a little bit less troublesome we'll say is good, and what's more troublesome we'll say is bad. Right? But then let's say you have another person what you would call more troublesome, for him is the less troublesome, and for he's got more, so he'll say that. But in any case, it's always just, there's just a little distance between the two. The liberated person being above the influence of the three modes of material nature. Okay, because everything here is miserable and troublesome, to create an artificial situation and pretend it to be full of happiness is simply illusion. The liberating, like, artificial situation, like you have a party, stay up all night, you know, like that. It's an artificial situation. Because normally you sleep at that time, because the next morning you feel terrible. Right? So, you know, so. The liberated person being above the influence of the three modes of material nature is unaffected by such dualities in all circumstances, right? Not just in some. You practice, in other words, you put yourself in ideal situations, you practice it. So then when you start to get an understanding of how it works and applies, so into, you know, controlled situations you can apply it, then as you apply it throughout your prescribed duties, then in situations that are not ideal, you'll be able to apply it. Right? So then one is liberated, because when one's applying it, one's liberated. And when one's not applying it, then one again is you know, acting with under the modes. Right? So it's just a matter of coming where liberate means it's no long, it's consistent. Right? He remains Krishna conscious by tolerating so-called happiness and distress. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 2.14. Those who are liberated, being on the transcendental platform of rendering service to the Lord, do not care about so-called happiness and distress. They know that these are like changing seasons, which are perceivable by contact with the material body. Happiness and distress come and go. Therefore, a pundit, a learned man, is not concerned with them. As it is said, Gatasun agatasumscha nanushochanti pandita. Bhagavad Gita 2.11. The body is dead from the very beginning because it is a lump of matter. Right? Body is dead, always dead, then dead. Just a matter of whether it's a, you know, how you say, whether it's a, how you say, you know, pre-composting, in the process of composting, or post-composting. Right? It has no feelings of happiness and distress. Because the soul within the body is in the bodily concept of life, he suffers happiness and distress. But these come and go. So it has nothing to do with the body. It's just our attachment to the body. So we'll say that situation is not real. Right? Okay, so then that ends Adhikarana 1, right, which is Sri Krishna, the Absolute Personality of God, who can be known through transcendental loving service. So it's only knowledge that comes from him, then you can get elevated. So by following that, then you can come to this liberated platform where you're not disturbed by the material world. So that is, you know, the first step in you know, Prayojana. Mm-hmm. Right, now here, Adhikarana 2. Bhagavad Gita is the cream of all the Vedas, Puranas, Upanishads, etc., and Sri Krishna, the Absolute Personality of Godhead, reveals himself as he is in the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, lessons 4 to 12. Okay, so lesson, okay, 4, that is 413. The Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god, Vivasvan, and Vivasvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshvaku. The supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in the course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost. That very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you, because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and can therefore understand the transcendental mystery of the science. Okay, so here is that Krishna We can only understand knowledge by hearing from Krishna. And the essence of all the knowledge that's given in all the Vedic literature is given in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, it's spoken by Krishna himself. Right? And so, therefore, that knowledge, if one can be appreciated, that knowledge having come from Krishna, if one accepts the principle that he is a devotee and a friend. Right? So friend means you follow his instructions and you try to encourage others to follow. Right? Devotee means you follow, friend means you encourage others to follow. Right? So that's the qualification. Bhagavad Gita should be accepted as it is. Because Bhagavad Gita, you haven't hit the footnote, there's the footnote. Because Bhagavad Gita is as good as the Vedas, being spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? This knowledge is apurusheya, superhuman. Right? So the Vedas are apurusheya because they come from the breathing of the Lord. Right? And now Krishna is speaking, so it's also apurusheya. It's also infallible. It's also superhuman, above the human consideration. Because that was the point before. Is happiness and distress is coming from the human perception, not from the transcendental perception. So here knowledge is coming, descending from the transcendental realm. So then everything will work very nicely. Since the Vedic instructions are accepted as they are, without human interpretation, the Gita must therefore be accepted without mundane interpretation. So we're saying here, human, we mean mundane. Mm-hmm. The mundane wranglers may speculate on the Gita in their own ways, but that is not Bhagavad Gita as it is. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita has to be accepted as it is, from the disciplic succession. And it is described herein that the Lord spoke to the sun god. The sun god spoke to his son Manu, and Manu spoke to his son Ikshvaku. Footnote 7. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.30, the impersonalist who has no idea of the transcendental form of the Lord cannot understand this most confidential message of the Lord. The expression most confidential is significant here because knowledge of devotional service is far, far above knowledge of impersonal Brahman. So confident means knowledge of Brahman is confidential because it's hidden. But it's not most confidential. Jnana means ordinary knowledge or any branch of knowledge. This knowledge develops up to the knowledge of impersonal Brahman. Above this, when it is partially mixed with devotion, such knowledge develops to knowledge of Paramatma, or the all-pervading Godhead. So here, we see this here, knowledge meaning ordinary knowledge or any branch of knowledge. Right? Ordinary means just, you know, day-to-day knowledge, general knowledge. Then a branch of knowledge where it gets very, you know, more scientific, more detailed, up to the knowledge of Brahman. That's all in one category. You know, it's just the extremes of the one category. Then, because that's just knowledge. So maybe a wide range, but it's just knowledge. Then when that knowledge mixed with devotion, then you get Paramatma. Right? Because otherwise you put it in all different. Because if it's not connected to the Lord, even Brahman realization is still avidya. It's still ignorance. But it only becomes actual knowledge when it's connected to the Lord. Above this, when it's partially mixed with devotion, such knowledge develops to knowledge of Paramatma, or the all-pervading Godhead. This is more confidential. But when such knowledge is turned into pure devotional service, and the confidential part of transcendental knowledge is attained, it is called the most confidential knowledge. So you have knowledge, then you have more confidential, then most confidential. This most confidential knowledge was imparted by the Lord to Brahma, Arjuna, Uddhava, etc. Yes?
Is this Manu Swayambhu Manu? Because it says he's the son of the sun god. And Manu is the son of Brahma.
It just means whatever, whoever happened to be the Manu at the time. Like that. You'd have to check. Because also sometimes somebody is the son of Brahma, like Bhrigu. But something happened, there was some curse, so he lost his body, so then he appeared again as the son of Varuna. Like that. So there's a few cases like that. You know, Prajumna. And then he ended up, you know, it came as Krishna's son. You know, this is like, when you're moving with the big boys, you know, there may be great success, but if you fail, it can be pretty disastrous. You know? Go and try to agitate Lord Shiva. You know, Cupid's just doing his job, but, you know, but then Lord Shiva burns him to ashes, so then, you know.
Would this be the origin of the Brihas Manu Siksha? Would this be the origin of it? Of the laws of Manu? Is it like that, that was put, the Bhagavad was taught to be the Swan?
It's the same knowledge. Because we see is now Bhagavad Gita is spoken on the Battle of Kurukshetra. So that's, you know, from what I understand, you know, Krishna, Arjuna, they're all like 125 years old. Right? But when Krishna was in Vrindavan as a child, Nanda Baba, sometimes when things were difficult, he would quote Bhagavad Gita. So Bhagavad Gita is a book of knowledge. You know, not you know, and so the publishment of Vedic knowledge means it's been spoken, right? How you say, Mahabharata was published at Janamejaya's snake sacrifice. I mean, it was spoken, first spoken, right? So then the Mahabharata, as Sutta Goswami spoke it to the sages of Naimisharanya. That's the second time it was published. Right, so the body of knowledge is there, just the line of saintly kings and the general understanding was lost. It doesn't mean it's totally lost. It means transcendental connection is never totally lost. It just becomes, you know, not very common, so it needs to be again brought back. Does that make sense? It's never lost. So like that. So these principles are in. We'll see when we get into the 6th chapter and 12th chapter. They're just dealing with the transcendental subject matter. Like that. So then you'll see it's the same point. But it's being given in relationship to the laws governing nature. You know, the nature of one's, how you say, one's acquired nature, like that. So therefore, it's there. Bhagavad Gita is just giving it as just directly the philosophy. That's why it's paravidya. Aparavidya means the philosophy is being given through the medium of another branch of knowledge. Like you take medicine. So if we give you transcendental knowledge, but explain it through the medium of medicine. Right, so however many aspects medicine have, that many are described. But in that, we're actually describing the supreme reality. But because of the nature of the language, presentation, the examples, one generally focuses on the knowledge that is being distributed through and not actually gain the understand the transcendental aspect. That's why it's called apara. You know, the medium is through is not transcendental. Though it's explaining transcendence, but because of that, one will have a tendency to become distracted. Does that make sense? So someone could be very expert in the Ayurvedic scriptures and not actually know the Vedanta at all. You know, does that make sense? But it's the same. It's the same knowledge. Right? So that's why we're going through Manu. So far, it doesn't sound like we're dealing with anything different than, you know, like this. The Gita is dealing with philosophy and the culture. Right? So Manu is dealing with the philosophy and the culture. But if you get too distracted by the form or the medium through which it's presented, then you actually end up with avidya. Right? In other words, if you see these branches of knowledge, this aparavidya, in its connection with the Lord, in the philosophy and practices, then it is aparavidya. But if you don't, it's avidya. It's not that, well, if I use it for, you know, proper and pious things, it's apara. If I use it sinfully, then it would be avidya. No. You see in connection with Vedanta, it's aparavidya. You don't, it's avidya. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. you know. And the fun part is, in this age where everybody talks about truth and being, you know, real, that one point very few want to hear. You know, especially those who always talk about being real. They don't want to hear about real reality. Like that. Because then you just said that their talk about reality is not reality. Okay. So we see in all these cases, to Brahma, he's directly speaking. To Arjuna, he's directly speaking. To Uddhava, he's directly speaking. To so many, he's directly speaking. Like that. I think, was it Markandeya? Or Maitreya? I think we spoke to both of them. In the Bhagavatam, then, I think, fourth canto is Maitreya, right? Maitreya, and then Maitreya speaks to Vidura. Yeah. Okay. 15:15. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of the Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. Okay, so Krishna gives remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So it's by his grace. So how much one is able to deal, that's his grace. And so he says, by all the Vedas I am to be known. It's not just by the transcendental knowledge. So every branch of the Vedas, every science that's given, every art, it's meant to know Krishna. It's not meant for something else. But we may tend to forget that. So that's avidya. And so he's the compiler of Vedanta. So that means that's, you know, it's the end of knowledge, and he's the knower of the Vedas. So, and he's saying is that it's by all the Vedas he's to be known, and that's what Vedanta is saying. One has to know the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right? All the Vedic literature describe the glories of Krishna. The living entity forgets as soon as he quits his present body, but he begins his work again, initiated by the Supreme Lord. Although he forgets, the Lord gives him the intelligence to renew his work where he ended his last life. Right? So you just continue where you left off. Doesn't mean in the necessarily the same position. You know, you like to be out in the fresh outdoors, and so next life, you know, you're one of the animals out in the fresh outdoors. You know, you come out of your burrow in the morning and smell the fresh air, you know, and fluff up your coat a little bit like that, and then go trotting off, you know, down the different paths and trails to see what you know, how you say, things can be gained and what enjoyments can be had, you know. So you're continuing the same work. So not only does the living entity enjoy or suffer in this world according to the dictation from the Supreme Lord situated locally in the heart, but he receives the opportunity to understand the Vedas from him. Right? So that means you forgetfulness of, you know, when you leave the body, you forget everything from last life. That's by the arrangement of the Lord. That you remember something, though you don't necessarily remember that's connected to last life. You just see something, wow, that's cool, and then you get right into it. You know, everybody else has also seen it, and they just, you know what I'm saying? You know, that one thing, incident, you know, you ask the person, well, what was your inspiration and all that? Well, when I was six, you know, then this happened. But everybody else was also six and also saw that, and they didn't become. So that's because the Lord reminded them of what was their desires previously, so therefore then they... Right? And then he gives the opportunity to of knowledge, so therefore you can therefore know the Lord. Even no matter what you've forgotten or what you remembered, you can still know the Lord. Yeah. If one is... Yeah. But he receives the opportunity to understand the Vedas from him. If one is serious about understanding the Vedic knowledge, then Krishna gives the required intelligence. If you're serious, he'll give the intelligence. You're not serious, he won't. Because why give something that you're not going to use? Why does he present the Vedic knowledge for understanding? Because a living entity individually needs to understand Krishna. The Vedic literature confirms this. Yo sau sarver veder gyate. In all Vedic literature, beginning from the four Vedas, Vedanta Sutra, and the Upanishads and Puranas, the glories of the Supreme Lord are celebrated. By performance of Vedic rituals, discussion of the Vedic philosophy, and worship of the Lord in devotional service, he is attained. Because the performance of the Vedic ritual is connected to the Lord. The mantras are connected to the Lord. The meanings are connected to the Lord. When you're doing rituals and all that, then there's naturally discussion of the philosophy. Right? Discussion of the subject matter. Therefore, the purpose of the Vedas is to understand Krishna. The Vedas give us direction by which to understand Krishna and the process of realizing it. Right, so how to know Krishna and how to realize. Right, the knowledge is there and the practices. By knowledge and practice you get realization. The ultimate goal is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vedanta Sutra 114 confirms this in the following words, Taktu Samanvayata. One can attain perfection in three stages. By understanding Vedic literature, one can understand his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By performing the different processes, one can approach him. At the end, one can attain the supreme goal, who is known other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We catch what was explained there? Yeah. And so... okay. One can attain perfection in three stages. So it wasn't that he just made those points. He says one can attain, so that's the meaning of tattu samandaya. So in these three stages, one can understand. So samanda abhideya prayoja. Understanding, one, you know, the literature, you understand your relationship with the Lord. Then you practice that, you apply that, and at the end, you attain the goal, and you can therefore approach the Lord in devotion. In this verse, the purport of the Vedas, the purpose of the Vedas, the understanding of the Vedas, and the goal of the Vedas are clearly defined. Right. So then.
Does that refer to the Vedanta Sutra verse or the Gita verse?
They're non-different. Because Gita, Vedanta Sutra is giving the essence of the Upanishads. Gita is also giving the essence of the Upanishads. Right? And Bhagavatam is giving the essence. So they're all the same. They're all the same study. Just Bhagavad Gita is like the ABCs of it. Vedanta Sutra is very technical, you know, giving everything in such concise form. But you don't have all the, you know, expansions and stories and everything that go with it. So Bhagavatam therefore becomes the perfect explanation of Vedanta. Right, because it's not only it's giving all the essence, it is the Vedanta, but it also gives all the applications, stories, different personalities, how they applied it in their life, how they became perfect. Is that? Yeah?
Is there any difference between the purpose and the goal?
Purpose is, no, it depends how you're putting it here. But your purpose is the understanding the practical of what it does. Goal is you know what you want to attain by that purpose. You can say. You could also say the goal means having obtained it actually. The purpose is what goal you could attain. You know, just like we sit here and go, okay, if we go over to the temple now then we could get you know prasad. Okay, so that's so therefore, by walking, we can get there. So the purpose is to get, you know, like that. The walking will get us, you know, what we're looking for. So the purpose of walking, it gets us the goal. So you can also say the purpose is your abhideya. But at the same time, it's also the prayojana aspect of sambandha. Right? But the point is the sambandha and abhideya means it's where you're applying the sambandha. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So there's everything's interconnected, but at the same time as you can make these three distinct areas so that you are able to understand them. But when you apply it, they're mixed. Just like, you know, you have the yoga ladder. You study each aspect of the ladder. But when it's applied, they're actually applied as one thing. Does that make sense? It means to do karma yoga, you have to have some knowledge, and you have to be able to focus on your goal. right? To Jnana Yoga, you also, of course, knowledge is there, but there's still activities within Jnana Yoga, and there's still your goal. You know, there's still some meditation. In Jnana Yoga, then there's that knowledge knowledge and practices. But it's just where the emphasis is. There, you call it Jnana Yoga because the meditation is the prominent aspect. Right, or is, you know, and its goal, you know, the jnana, that's its prominent aspect and goal. The karma, that's its prominent aspect and goal. But all of them contain the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like to give charity, then you're having to, it's a sacrifice, right? And you're doing it because it's your duty, so it's an austerity. But because you're giving something away, it's called charity. Right? Does that make sense? So it's always like you're doing the ritual, right? But it's your duty to do that ritual, and in that ritual, something's being given away. But the focus is on the ritual, not on the giving away of it. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. So all three contain the other. You know, so that's why. We're discussing so many elements that we might say are sambandha in this third section. I mean, in this section. Well, this is sambandha, this one, isn't it? I finished it, yeah, we're on the third. But when we were doing the third one, it was explaining, but it would start all the way back in sambandha. If you have these things and you apply them, then you'll get this result. Right, the other one is that, you know, we want to get that result, so this has to be done. You know what I'm saying? Like that, or this knowledge is necessary. Mm-hmm. You want to perform an activity, you have to have this knowledge. So it's just which aspect you're taking as the final point you're getting to. So to establish sambandha, you have to establish abhidhaya and prayojan. But if you're establishing abhidhaya and prayojan, so sambandha is clear. Or you have to establish sambandha and prayojana to make abhidhaya clear. And sambandha and abhidhaya to make prayojana clear. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's why it appears there's overlaps and it's confusing. Everyone wants to have, you know, completely separate things. They're always completely separate. It's going to remain like that. But that's only preliminary study. Preliminary study, you separate the elements like that. Like when you learn medicine, the first thing you do is learn how to take the body apart piece by piece, and each thing, and what this does and what that does and all that. But then after that, you have to learn how they work together, and therefore if you have this symptom, it's because of all these other aspects. Does that make sense? So if we leave it on simply, you know, is it this or is it that? No, but it's a combination. That takes a more mature understanding. So if we're only still working on, you know, these little box, little things, it means our understanding is not very deep because we're not able to use them together. Right? Okay, in this verse, the purpose of the Vedas, the understanding of the Vedas, and the goal of the Vedas are clearly defined. Right? So the purpose means that it will get you the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the goal. Right? The Vedas are for that give you the knowledge and process by which you can obtain. Footnote 8. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 6.232, in the beginning of his life, Ajamil was certainly very pure, and he associated with devotees and brahmanas. Because of that pious activity, even though he was fallen, he was inspired to name his son Narayan, because he was from a high-grade Brahmin family. Right, and then he's associating with devotees and brahmins and all that. So because of that background, then later on, even though he's very degraded, he was inspired to name his son Narayan. Right? You know, it's just like, let's say he has some, you know, that you know, how you say, you know, the husband and wife, and they've just, you know, come back from the local, you know, maternity hospital, you know, they're in their you know, four-wheel drive, you know, muscle pickup truck, you know, their shotguns in the back window, you know, they drive up to their, you know, country home like that, their dog comes running out, and, you know, all these things like this, and they go into the house, and they're thinking, wow, what will we name the kid? And then Narad Muni, you know, suddenly walks in, and he says, I recommend you name your child Narayana, like that, you know, and then are they going to go, wow, great name, you know? They're going to go, say what? You know? You know?
Them spite words.
Yeah, you know, it's just like, you know, the guy may signal to his wife to go out to get the shotgun.
Yeah.
You know, who's this guy? You know? You know what I'm saying? Because of his previous piety, he was inspired. Certainly this was due to good counsel given from within by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sani Vishto, Mata Smritya Jnanam Apohanam Cha. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. The Lord who is situated in everyone's heart is so kind that if one has ever rendered service to him, the Lord never forgets him. So he rendered service before, but he forgot. He fell, from what I understand, when he was 20. You know, and when we come into the story, is when he was, you know, how you say, he probably was in his 90s, because Narayan was born when he was, how you say, 88. You know, and so now he has to be big enough to recognize his name and come, so he would be like, you know, 2-3 years old. Like that. So that's a 70-year gap. But the Lord doesn't forget. Ajamio may have forgotten, but the Lord doesn't forget. Thus the Lord, from within, gave Ajamio the opportunity to name his youngest son Narayana, so that in affection he would constantly call Narayana, Narayana, and thus be saved from the most fearful and dangerous condition at the time of his death. Such is the mercy of Krishna. Oh, that was a footnote. Bottom of the footnote, but not bottom of the page.
It's true.
Okay, right? So now the Lord, and so remembers, right? You know, so you see that. So many times the devotees are going along, they've rendered service, they are not necessarily well situated, they're out doing whatever they're doing, and something comes up, and then they just remember. You know, again, Krishna, remember Prabhupada, like that, and then they start coming back and associating. So Krishna is very kind. He doesn't forget them. He just creates that opportunity. Right? But, you know, they had their desires. Those desires are being fulfilled. They're working through them. And then Krishna allows it to remember again. Right? Because if that happened earlier, they still wouldn't. You know, because there's so many of the issues or the desires or whatever it is. But now it's been time. Now it comes up, then they'll, oh, okay. You know, so for Ajamila it took 70 years. And for, you know, generally for most devotees we see, you know, 10 years is a pretty standard if they're really out there. And sometimes maybe 20, but generally not any more than that. You know? Lesson 5. Sri Krishna is recognized by Arjuna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not only on the strength of the authoritative recognition of the great saints and sages, but also on his own transcendental personal experience as a constant friend and companion of Krishna. So 10:12-16. Arjuna said, "You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute. You are the eternal, transcendental, original person, the unborn, the greatest. All the great sages such as Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyas confirm this truth about you. And now you yourself are declaring it to me. O Krishna, I totally accept as truth all that you have told me. Neither the demigods nor the demons, O Lord, can understand your personality. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency. O Supreme Person," right, so therefore, we're only going to, if Krishna, he knows himself through his internal potency, that means we're only going to know Krishna through his internal potency. So there's no question of directly interacting with Krishna without being the servant of his servants. Because he knows himself through his internal potency. Right? Because how do you know his great? How does God know his greatness? By the expansion of his creation. That's his internal potency. Is that what it is? But he is Rasa. How does he know that? Because his devotees, the internal potency, see him in all those different rasas. Does that make sense? So we're only going to know him through his internal potency. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency. O Supreme Person, origin of all, Lord of all beings, God of gods, Lord of the universe, please tell me in detail of your divine opulences by which you pervade all these worlds. Right, so God of gods, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, he says God of Godhead means God of gods. You know, and then within that. Arjuna is freed from all doubts. In these two verses, the Supreme Lord gives a chance to the Mayavadi philosopher. For here it is clear that the Supreme is different from the individual soul. Arjuna, after hearing the essential four verses of Bhagavad Gita, 10:8 through 11, in this chapter, became completely free from all doubts and accepted Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He at once boldly declares, "You are Param Brahma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead." And previous Krishna has stated, "He is the origin of everything and everyone. Every demigod and every human being is dependent on Him. Men and demigods out of ignorance think they are absolute and independent of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That ignorance is removed perfectly by the discharge of devotional service." So perfectly, there's nothing left out. Devotional service is the natural platform. So that means if you're situated in devotional service, then there's nothing, there's no other element that, how do you say, is outside that, right? Because one is not understanding one's position, so one is engaging in activities that are not devotional. So if one understands one's situation, then the devotional position perfectly addresses all non-devotional issues. This has already been explained in the previous verse by the Lord. Now by His grace, Arjuna is accepting Him as the Supreme Truth in concordance with the Vedic injunction. It is not that because Krishna is Arjuna's intimate friend, Arjuna is flattering him by calling him the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth. Whatever Arjuna says in these two verses is confirmed by Vedic truth. Vedic injunctions affirm that not only one who takes the devotional service to the Supreme Lord can understand him. Vedic injunctions affirm that only one who takes the devotional service to the Supreme Lord can understand him, whereas others cannot. Each and every word of this verse spoken by Arjuna is confirmed by Vedic injunction. So Krishna has already explained how he removes the ignorance. Right? He says, like the bee is there and it takes, the honey out of the flowers and all that. So the Lord in the heart, then he removes the ignorance from the heart of the sincere devotee. So that's there. So now Arjuna is then saying, then confirming, according to Shastra, that of the great personality is that he is the Supreme Personality. 414, yes.
Devotional service, but not maybe knowing your Krishna, just being engaged in that service.
Yeah. Yes, Agyata Sutra means devotional service, whether it's known or unknown, is eternal. So if one has performed Agyata Sukriti, he didn't know it was devotional service. But that Agyata Sukriti lasts. So even if they don't take advantage of the next life, then again they'll be given the opportunity.
And maybe if they knew it was devotional service, but they don't
like
to Krishna?
Then it's a little stronger. You know, because then they're voluntarily doing it. The other one, they don't know what's going on, right? You know, that was Jayadwaita Maharaj's complaint about distributing prasad and not having the people who are eating it know it's prasad, because then it could be devotional service, but you're only affording them agyata sukriti. You know what I'm saying? So devotion is so much more powerful. So that's his point, is that, and the reason that's being done many times is not necessarily the element that, well, if they know it's prasad, they won't eat it, so at least they're eating. It's more the element that, you know, we're doing welfare work, and because we're doing welfare work, then all the other groups will appreciate us, and so therefore we'll have a better status. You know what I'm saying? That's the difficulty. So it's not even technically in the minds of the devotees the Agyata Sukriti. It's we're engaging, nice pious work, you know, in the Lord's service. Mm-hmm. So it's the devotee who's arranging it is technically getting the benefit, but in his mind, it's not so much the people who are eating the food. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Though they are getting benefit. But when he's addressing, he's not out on the street, you know, saying this, what's it, food for death, and you know, stuff like that. He's not telling the guys who are eating it that's like that. He's telling the ones who are organizing it. Is that, you know, you're implicating yourself just in the concepts of just good and nice. So they'll continue to go on. But you could, by telling it it's prasad and they're taking it, then they would get more benefit. Yes.
And you could ask, what's the capacity for, you know, some 6-year-old in an impoverished area to really grasp that it's prasadam? I mean, you're going to announce it, by the way, this is prasadam. It's like, great.
The bus goes out that you know anything is Hare Krishna's or anything like that. Before you go out, and the devotees go out there, and there might be some kirtan or some Prabhupada's tape playing or this and that, but now it's just, you know, the guy gets out of the bus in his uniform and distributes the prasad, and all they know is that's another NGO coming out to distribute some free food. Though they're getting benefit. But there's no, you know, you can have a picture of Krishna on the side of the bus, or, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, so then there's something there. But that's the 6-year-old. Okay, that's the 6-year-old. What about everybody else who's there? What about the 6-year-old's mom and dad and older brother and sister and uncle? Okay, the dog also won't get, no. So he'll only get a gyata sukriti. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that's the, you know, because whether it's food for life or it's UNICEF or it's this one or that one, later on, how are you going to remember? You know? But if it's Hare Krishna, then they'll know it's Hare Krishna. They'll remember it's Hare Krishna. Is that anything? Yes? No?
Well, yeah, but it says ISKCON for life. So that much.
But what does ISKCON mean? You know what I'm saying? We're not, it means the detail of it is not what's important. What we're bringing out here is the aspect of it came from the Agyata Sukriti. So her question was, is Agyata Sukriti, is it eternal? Does it go on? So yes, so there is benefit. But what we're saying is that more benefit can be given if it's understood its directness, rather than simply its indirectness.
Yeah.
That's all. You know? So, if the situation is you can't be more direct, it means you have to have a permit to distribute food on the street, and the local, you know, municipality won't allow it if they think it's a religious thing. It has to be an NGO. Then yes, then you do that. But if it's, you know, the Christians are distributing food, the Buddhists are distributing food, why not the Hare Krishnas? Then why wouldn't we do it like that? That's the point. You know, so it means if we could go down the street and do Hare Nam dressed as devotees, why wouldn't we? But if we can't, then you're dressed in karmi clothes and you're going and having programs inside the house, because otherwise you end up in jail. Then we do it that way. The point is whatever is the maximum benefit to be gained, but from all angles, you'll take that. And if you can't do that, then of course you take some other angle. Right? You know, it's just like you can say that, okay.
The more conscious people are that this is Krishna devotees.
Yes, it's Krishna devotees. Then it's more, even if it doesn't have much significance to them, but it still has something.
Yeah.
Because they're eating, they're seeing, they're hearing. So you're engaging more of the senses in this process. Mm-hmm. Right? So then it means that it's a matter of volume of gyatak sukriti generates faith. So if you just give them a small amount of agyata sukriti, it'll take much more volume to get there. But if there's more volume in one contact, then there's more happening. You know what I'm saying? So that's why festival means it's so many aspects. So all the senses are engaged. There's more things. It's greater. It's more full. More intense. So there's more to deal with, to elevate you, to absorb. Does that make sense? That's the idea. Yes.
Are we mostly like going around doing our sadhana and our prescribed duties in a state of agyata sukriti? Because I know I'm understanding in a lot of your classes, you're asking us to, like when we were talking about, you know, what kind of furniture you have in your house and why did you choose that and why are you washing your clothes and why are you keeping your room clean? So like for most of us, we're really on our automatic conditioning and value, and so we're mostly very unconscious of linking what we're doing. I'm doing this because this pleases Krishna, and I want to please Krishna. So are most of us really going around doing things in agyata sukriti?
Agyata sukriti means you don't know, you haven't committed yourself to the devotional process. You may do a devotional activity, but you're not committed to performing it because of this being a devotional activity. Once you've made that decision, then you're doing devotional service.
Because I understand a different definition of devotional service, that it's not devotional service unless you're fully conscious that you are doing this.
No, but then it's called mixed devotional service. Right? So in other words, for someone who hasn't taken up the process, it's agyata sukriti. For someone who has, then it's mixed devotional service or pure devotional service. Right? So there's times it may be pure, times it may be mixed. Like that. So, you know, or at times you're just unconscious, you know.
Correct. Yeah, mixed meaning unconscious mood.
Yeah, to some degree. So maybe sometimes the unconsciousness is very prominent. So, yeah. So the point is no, for the devotees, they're not doing agyata sukriti. It's mixed emotional service. Yeah, like that. You know, Prahlad Maharaj, that's, you know, in his previous life, that's agyata sukriti. They're not, the place that they're cleaning, they don't know is the temple. You know, and that they're fasting, they don't know that it's Nrisimha Chaturdasi. You know, like that, so.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Shri Prabhupada ki
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki
Jai
Jai Nitai Gaur Premi.